I don't know if I mentioned the fact that the Locklears are still out of town. That's the reason why I'm standing before you this morning. If I failed to do that, I apologize to them. But Steve called this morning and told me to tell everybody hi. So let's continue to remember them in our prayers as they are traveling. This morning, we're going to spend some time in the genealogies of Genesis. Yay, right? The he begats, and they live for thousands or 900 and something years. Most of the time we get to the genealogies and we skip them because it's a hard time pronouncing the names. But there is truth in these genealogies for us. In particular, the ones we're going to look at this morning in Genesis chapter 4. And we're going to talk about two families. And we're going to examine their different perspectives on life. And we're going to see how eventually they came to the same perspective. And then we're going to look at the consequences of that. And in the process, we're going to identify who the sons of God are and the daughters of men are as an incidental thing, at least related to this lesson. And the families we're going to talk about are the families of Cain and Seth. We're introduced to Cain, of course. It's a story familiar to us all in Genesis chapter 4, verses 1 through 16. And most of us, if not all of us, are familiar with the story. By faith, Abel offered a more excellent sacrifice than did his brother Cain. And that act of Abel was righteous. God deemed it righteous. Abel did what God told him to do. Cain, on the other hand, did what Cain wanted to do. He was honoring God as he saw fit instead of how God saw fit. And we see this attitude of Cain stayed with him for his entire life, and it affected his entire family, and ultimately it affected the entirety of the human race. And we'll see that as we go along. But in chapter 4 and verse 17, and we also know that Cain, out of jealousy for his brother, rose up and killed him. And the language there says that he cut his throat. He was sacrificing his brother as if to say, okay, if you want this type of sacrifice, I'm going to give it to you. Talking about God, I'm going to give it to you in the fact that I'm offering my brother. But in chapter 4 and verse 17, we read, Cain knew his wife. This is afterwards. He's in the land of Nod, where he's wandering. Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch. When he had built a city, he called the name of the city after his son, Enoch. To Enoch was born Irad, and Irad fathered Mehujael, and Mehujael fathered Methushael, and Methushael fathered Lamech. And Lamech took two wives. The name of the one was Adah, and the name of the other was Zillah. Adah bore Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those who play the lyre and the pipe. Zillah also bore Tubal-Cain. He was the forger of instruments of bronze and iron. And the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. So we see Cain fathers a son, and he names him Enoch. And Enoch means dedication or train. And in that moment, or in response to that birth of his son, Cain decides to build him a city. And in response to that, he builds him a city. And we see in that that Cain is focused on the physical things of his life. He's dedicating a city to his son. And through his son, Cain will be remembered upon this earth, that men will remember him, that he will be something in other people's eyes. And we see in this, and it will become clear as we go along, that Cain's perspective was life here upon this earth. It was pride in self and recognition above men. And again, we'll see this more and more as we go along. And then in chapter 4 and verse 25, we're introduced to the family of Seth. And Adam knew his wife, verse 25, Genesis 4. And Adam knew his wife, and she bore a son and called his name Seth, for she said, God has appointed for me another offspring instead of Abel, for Abel killed him. To Seth was also born a son, and he called his name Enosh. At that time, people began to call upon the name of the Lord. So Seth bears a son, and he names him Enosh. And this is an interesting name, what it means. Enosh means man or mortal, frail, to be weak. And names meant something in the Bible, not so much today, but when people named their children in the Bible, it generally meant something. And we saw this in the study of Isaiah, if you recall. Do you remember the two sons of Isaiah? The first one, his was named Shear Yeshub. And Shear Yeshub, and we understand what Isaiah was about. He's prophesying destruction is coming. Change your ways. The Lord is going to destroy this nation and you will be carried into captivity. His first son was named Shear Yeshub, which means a remnant shall return. So through the name of his son, the Lord was prophesying to the people of Israel that you're going into captivity, but ultimately a remnant will return. And his other son, his second son, was Maher Shalal Hasbaz. A long name, but that name meant swift to the prey, demonstrating that the Assyrian Empire, as a ravenous animal, a ravenous beast, God was going to bring them against the people of Judah. And as Isaiah went about with his sons and the Judeans, knowing the names of this, they're reminded every time they see Isaiah and his sons of the Lord's word. Whether they believe it or not, they know what these names mean, so they were reminded. Those names meant something. And Enosh did as well. And I can imagine Seth as he's holding this child. And all of us who have had children have been in that moment when our first child is born and we're like, what now? What do I do with this? Because we realize in that moment how frail. And I don't think when Seth saw Enosh, I don't think that he saw in the child a sick child. After all, Enosh lived 905 years. Usually frail children don't live that long. So I don't think that's what he's saying in that moment, or the reason why he's naming that. He's seeing this child and he realizes how helpless this child is. That without its parents, it can do nothing of itself. And in that realizing the frailty, as we look at the bigger picture and compare ourselves to God, that we are in a similar situation as this newborn child. Because as we walk this earth, we are completely and utterly helpless without God. And just as this child is helpless without his parents in that moment, so are we. And Seth realized that. It drew his attention to the mortality of man. In seeing the frailty of this child, he sees the frailty of himself and the frailty of the entire human race before God. And it jarred something in Seth. He may have been a religious type, and it seems like that he was, but this woke him up. And he realized in that moment his need for God, for humanity's need for God. And his response was, men began to call upon the Lord because Seth realized that I need this. His perspective was not of the flesh, of physical things, but for a need for God, he manifested a humble spirit. And in these two families, again, we have a contrast in perspectives. Cain's family is focused on the here and now. They are carnal. They are fleshly. They are about accomplishments and the look at me kind of attitude. They have a physical perspective. And we see this in his children. They are the father. Well, first of all, he built a city. Who builds a city for their child? Oh, my mom and dad, they're putting away money. They're going to send me to Harvard. Well, big deal. My dad owns the city. I own the college. He built his son a city. Regardless of how big it was a city that he built for his son.
And he named it after his son. People come around, oh, this is Enoch, the city that Cain built for his son, you see? Jabal was the originator, the father of animal husbandry. And as we study the Old Testament, we realize what animals under the Old Testament were, right? That's money. That's cash money. You were determined to be, your wealth status was determined by how much livestock you had. We see it in Abraham and others. Those who had vast flocks were considered to be rich men because at that time they were. And then musicians. Jubal was the inventor of music and instrumental music. And the forgers of metal, Tubal-Cain, the father of the forgers of metal. Now think of the process of coming up with that, of figuring all of that out, because forging metals is an involved process, especially in this time of human history with the materials and the technology they had at that time. So these are very brilliant things that the children of Cain came up with, but again, it's all a physical, here and now, on this earth focus. Seth's family, on the other hand, their accomplishments were spiritual. They realized, I need God. They walked with God. They had a spiritual perspective, and they called upon him, we see again in verse 26 of chapter 4. And this is made even clearer in the seventh generation. This is where we find Lamech, the son of Cain, and Enoch, interestingly, the son of Seth. Lamech was a proud and boastful man. Look at verse 19. First of all, Lamech took two wives. Lamech took two wives. Now, what does this tell us? This tells us that Lamech is the first polygamist. You remember God's law, marriage law. Jesus brings our attention back to that in Matthew chapter 19, right? For this reason, man shall leave a father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And Jesus says, what God has put together, let not man put asunder. And he's pointing back to Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24, God's original marriage law. Lamech completely disregarded that. Again, he has the attitude of his father Cain, which is, I will do things my way. And that's the idea of what he's doing here. He as one preacher said, one woman wasn't enough for Lamech. And he had two. And he says something to them in verse 23. Lamech said to his wives, Ada and Zillah, hear my voice. You wives of Lamech, listen to what I say. I'm about to tell you what you got. I'm about to let you know how good you have it in the man category, is the idea here. Look at your husband. I have killed a man for wounding me. A young man for striking me. Listen to this. If Cain's revenge is sevenfold, do you remember that? Cain is worried after he kills his brother. He's worried that people will see me and they'll kill me, and God marks him. And if somebody kills Cain, God says, I will avenge him sevenfold. That's what Lamech's looking back to. If Cain's revenge is sevenfold, then Lamech's is 70. Sevenfold, seven times that, 70 times that will be Lamech's. Look at me. He gloried in his sin. It reminds me of the gunslingers back in the West. They're sitting down at the table. They're about to play some cards. One of them slaps down his wanted poster. Look at here. I'm worth $5,000. And then another one slaps his down and says, well, that's nothing. They got $10,000 on my head. He's glorying in his sin, in his flesh, of what he perceives to be his accomplishment. He valued himself. And then we have Enoch. Look at chapter 5. Chapter 5 and verse 22. Chapter 5 and verse 22. Enoch walked with God after he followed Methuselah 300 years,
and had other sons and daughters. Thus all the days of Enoch were 365 years. Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. Enoch's mind was set on the Spirit. Two times it is said he walked with God, and God took him. In Hebrews 11 and verse 5, we read, "By faith Enoch was taken up, that he should not see death, and he was not found." It's as if he just disappeared from the earth. People began asking, "Well, where's Enoch? Where God took him?" That's the idea, it seems to be, of what happened here. God took him. He was not found because God had taken him. We see the value that Lamech placed upon himself, and here we see the value that God placed upon Enoch. One writer said, referencing this what we're talking about here, "Cain's family is a microcosm. Its pattern of technical prowess and moral failure is that of humanity." Reckon how the world viewed the Cain family. All these people with these great accomplishments. Oh, what's that beautiful sound I hear as I'm walking into the city of Enoch? Well, as you walk into the city that Cain built for his son Enoch, that beautiful sound that you're hearing is music. It was invented by a son of Cain named Jubal. Well, it's delightful. He's an awesome dude. Yes, and we're familiar with that kind of idea. No doubt they were praised for their genius. They were held to be great men. And the same thing happens today. Benjamin Franklin was the inventor of many things. Not only was he a founder of one of the founding fathers of the country, he was busy with a lot of things. He invented the lightning rod, the Franklin stove. He invented swim fins. You know, the things divers use and some swimmers use. He was an avid swimmer, and he came up with those things. He also invented bifocals. It might not mean something to a lot of people, but it does to me because I have bifocals on, and I'm thankful for them. And let me tell you, if I ever met the inventor of the air conditioner walking down downtown Fort Worth in August, I'd give him a hug. Because that's a wonderful thing. Alexander Graham Bell, Bill Gates. Think of the influence that Bill Gates has had on the world. The software that his company has developed. And the influence it has on your life, my life, and the life of the world, and the glory that is heaped upon him because of that. Elon Musk, the Rolling Stones, as the world is viewing this, Mick Jagger, 78 years old. Charlie Watts just died, the lifelong drummer of the Rolling Stones. He just died. They've replaced him. They kept on. They ain't missed a lick. They're still touring. They got somebody else on the drums, touring away. And Keith Richards has been said to be the most eloquently wasted citizen in human history. Glorying in the fact that Keith Richards is this supposed great big partier. And this is how the world sees and holds these people in high regard. And no doubt the same was true for the Cain family, again, because of the focus on the here and now. And we ask ourselves, what do you hope to accomplish in life? What have you accomplished? Because when you think of the Bill Gates and the Elon Musk and these musicians, these great inventors, they have accomplished much. But at what cost? And how did they go about that? And we ask ourselves the same question. What is our focus? Is your focus college, school? And by focus, I mean, is that where your mind, that you are centered? Is that what is driving you? Is college your life? I understand that college is important. I'm not knocking that, but I'm saying, what is driving you? Is it college? Is it my job? Is it the fact that I intend to marry and have kids? And there's nothing wrong with all of that. But again, the question is, what is driving you? Is that your life and God is a compartment of your life? Or is God driving the train in all of that?
The physically successful life is an accomplishment, but it is completely worthless absent spiritual focus. Turn to Matthew chapter 16. Matthew chapter 16. And it's a familiar passage, so let's prepare ourselves for a familiar passage, okay? Because sometimes, if you're anything like me, I can get to a familiar passage if I'm not careful, and I will cloud over. Have you ever experienced that? And that's wrong for me to do that, because we are talking about God's Word here. We're talking about the words of Jesus Christ. So keep that in mind, and let's focus and bring our attention to that as we read this passage. Matthew chapter 16, verse 24. Matthew chapter 16, verse 24. Jesus says to his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself." Let him deny himself. Well, what does that mean, to deny myself? It means that you subordinate every desire of your heart, every affection that you have, to doing God's will. Denying ourselves for God's will. If I want to do this, but God's will says do that, then I do what God says. That's what's being talked about when we deny ourselves. And Jesus says, if you're going to be my follower, if you're coming after me, if you're going to get recognition from me, you must do that. Deny yourself and take up your cross. And I'm willing to accept whatever burden comes from that, to the point of losing my life if necessary. That's what it means to deny yourself in the service of the Lord Jesus, and to take up your cross and follow him. The question for me is, am I doing that? Is that the focus in my life? Or am I more focused on the things of this earth? My job, college, retirement, or what have you. Again, what is driving the train in your life? What is driving the train in my life? Is what was driving the family of Cain's train driving yours? Or is it the family of Seth? For verse 25, "For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man? For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul?" He's not contrasting. He's not just talking about someone who has all the riches in this life. Even that is not worth the soul. What he's focused on is giving up our souls over the physical things of this life. And many people do that. And we see that attitude expressed in the family of Cain. And then later on we see, well, let's turn to Psalm 49. Let's look at some passages here talking about some of the things that we're addressing. Psalm 49. Psalm 49, verse 5 beginning. "Why should I fear in times of trouble?" And these are warnings to the rich. David is suffering, or the psalmist is suffering at the hands of the rich. "Why should I fear in times of trouble when the iniquity of those who cheat me surrounds me? Those who trust in their wealth and boast of the abundance of their riches. Truly no man can ransom another or give to God the price of his life." Bill Gates ain't going to stand before the richest man in the world, whoever it is, on any given day, is not going to stand before God in the day of judgment and ransom his life with his wealth, because his wealth is on fire at that moment with the rest of the world. The cost is too high. It's not based in money. It's not based, our souls are not based in physical things. "For the ransom of their life is costly and can never suffice, that he should live on forever and never see the pit. For he sees that even the wise die. The fool and the stupid alike must perish and leave their wealth to others. Their graves are their homes forever, their dwelling places to all generations, though they called lands by their own names." They had cities named after them, towns, countries, states. Doesn't matter. When this world's on fire, it doesn't matter.
Man is, we're in verse 12 now. Man in his pomp will not remain. He was like the beast that perished. We're all headed to the grave. Verse 15, but God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. And we understand what the price of that was. That was the Lord Jesus dying upon the cross. Be not afraid when a man becomes rich, when the glory of his house increases, for when he dies, he will carry nothing away. His glory will not go down after him. For though while he lives, he counts himself blessed. And though you get praise when you do well for yourself, the praise of men, people feed on that. You think of a rock, you think of somebody still doing sold out stadium shows, again, thinking about the Stones at nearly 80 years old, the glory that is heaped upon them as they do these shows and how intoxicating that is for them. Though you get praise when you do well for yourself, his soul will go to the generations of his fathers who will never again see the light. Man in his pomp, yet without understanding, is like the beast that perish. It's all coming to an end. When our hope and trust is in physical things, the life here upon this earth, when we compartmentalize God and make him just a part of our life instead of the totality of our lives, then we find ourselves in the same situation. And we see this happen with these two families. Chapter 6, we see this happen with them because there is a merger that occurs. Chapter 6, verse 1 through 8, there's a merger that occurs, and the consequences of this are catastrophic. The sons of God looked upon the daughters of men and saw that they were beautiful. Who are the sons of God? Who are the daughters of men? There's a lot of speculative theories related to these two. Some say it was angels came to the earth and had relations with women and then these sons of God were born. That's not it. There are others that say that it was aliens. And as a result of this, the giants resulted. But keep in mind what's occurring here. The text is following two families. Families with different and distinct perspectives. And so the sons of God are the descendants of Seth, and the daughters of men are the descendants of Cain. And tragically, the sons of Seth, became sensual. Just like the sons of Cain. It began, verse 2 of chapter 6, when the sons of God saw the beauty of the daughters of men. Now, do you think that these women just now became beautiful as they recognized it? And before they were veritable buffaloes running the plains? No, they'd always been beautiful, just like the other daughters of men. They'd always been beautiful, but now a perspective is changing. Before, the sons of Seth understood that this is not what we want to get involved with because they do not honor God. Now the perspective is physical, it's sensual. They see their beauty, they focus on that, and then they go after the beauty. And as we've stated, the consequences of this are catastrophic. Eve, she saw the fruit and that it was good, right? The fruit just didn't then turn good. Eve's perspective changed. Through the influence of the serpent, her perspective about the fruit changed. Same thing's going on here. They were always beautiful, but now their perspective has changed. They're focused on the sensual, the physical, instead of the spiritual. And this mingling created a conflict with God. Jesus said, you can't serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to one and despise the other. Romans 6 and verse 16, you're the slaves to the one whom we obey, either of sin unto death or of obedience unto righteousness. And God said in verse 3, my spirit shall not strive with man forever. This mingling caused the sons of God to cease being the sons of God, and both families became wicked. Look at chapter 6 and verse 5. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. What began this?
The sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful. This is what began all of this. And then verse 12. And God saw that the earth, or saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And we see the results of that were catastrophic. It led to the near annihilation of the entirety of the human race. When the spiritual person makes a decision based on, from a sensual or physical perspective, he ceases being spiritual and becomes the enemy of God. Look at Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8 and verse 5 beginning. For those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the flesh, but those who live according to the Spirit set their minds on the things of the Spirit. For to set the mind on the flesh is death, but to set the mind on the Spirit is life and peace. For the mind that is set on the flesh is hostile to God. This is the daughters of men. This is the lineage of Cain. This is the family of Cain. For the mind that is set on the flesh is hostile to God, for it does not submit to God's law. Indeed, it cannot. It cannot because it is set on the flesh. And when the sons of God intermingled with that, the influence was, people have the idea, well, I will, they're hanging with some wild-eyed person, I'll convert them. But more often than not, it's the other way around, and that's what we see as these two families came together. And again, God destroyed humanity because of this, of what it led to. So we talk about the seriousness of what we're involved with here. You think of the divine being destroying humanity because of what they became as a result of this merger. Those who completely gave up on God and went about life in their own way. There's no middle ground in this. Our decisions are made from one of these two perspectives. Either we have our mind set on the Spirit, or our minds are set upon the flesh. And there's three areas where we make sensual decisions, and we could expand this, but these are three that I think will help us, and especially our young people, not just the young people, but as they are contemplating the futures of their life, but three areas where we make sensual decisions. One is selecting a mate. The sons of God looked upon the daughters of men and saw that they were beautiful, and they married them. And an example of a sensual choosing of a mate is Samson in Judges chapter 14. You remember he's returning from Timnah. He saw a beautiful woman among the Philistines, and he tells his parents, "Go get her for me." And they're saying, "Well, why can't you get one from among your own people?" He says in verse 3, depending on your translation, "She looks good to me." And why would he want a Philistine woman? They were the enemies of God, had been the enemies of God, remained the enemies of God throughout the entirety of their existence. Served idols, several at a time, a lascivious, unbelieving people. Why would a child of God want to marry a Philistine woman? And we see Samson's attitude about these things, of what it led to for him. Spiritual selecting of a mate we find in Proverbs chapter 31. We're familiar with that passage. We're not going to read the whole thing, but in verse 10 of that chapter, "A worthy woman who can find, her price is far above rubies." Her price is far above rubies. Young men, if you find a godly woman, you will have acquired a treasure untold. On the flip side of that, if you marry a woman for her beauty and her beauty alone, and she is as the sons or the daughters of men, and she is of a fleshly bent of mind, she's going to turn ugly on you real quick.
In verse 30 of Proverbs chapter 31, the proverb writer goes on to say, charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. And it's talking about men as well. Because let me tell you something, young people. As a person who's been there, as all moms and dads who are here today have been there, if you're not attuned with God right now, you've got just an idea, you're going about your life, you're not giving much consideration to it. Once you marry and you bear a child, if you have any love for God at all, your attitude towards that will change in a moment, because now you understand I'm responsible for this soul. Yes? I'm responsible. A lot of what happens to this child when he dies depends on me. And now, whether you're man or woman, you've married a worldly person, a person who has no interest in the things of God at all. Now you have this child, and you're going to have to raise this child. And this child is going to come up in life. You're trying to teach it the ways of God. And as you're teaching it the ways of God, it's understanding that my father's not living like this. You are talking about the child's father. Or my mother's not living like this. You're telling me that I'm supposed to embrace this, live like this, but mom is not living that way. Is mom going to hell? It'll change. It'll change in that moment. If you're of the flesh, it's not going to matter. You'll carry on. If your mind is set on the flesh, as you begin your life and you form that union, that unbreakable union in the eyes of God, you form that union and you go about your life and it won't matter. But if you have an inkling right now, an inkling of the love of God in your heart, it's going to change when you have children. I guarantee you. And now you're in a rough spot. You love your husband, you love your wife. Now you're trying to teach your children. Now you're trying to help them go to heaven when they die, and they've got this conflicting message going on in the home. And it will be a conflicting message. And it will cause you undue pain in your life as you realize that I'm not making headway with this child. In regard to spiritual things. 1 Peter chapter 3. Men, this is the woman you're supposed to be looking for. Young men, not the beauty queen, not the cheerleader. We won't go down that road today. Not the cheerleader. Proverbs 31. That woman, as well as this one, it's the same woman and the same man. 1 Peter 3 and verse 3, do not let your adorning be external. Adorning is how you put yourself together. Not just physically what you're wearing. It's how you put yourself together. How you conduct yourself. The way we dress manifests that in a way. But that's the idea of what we're talking about. Don't let your adorning be external, the braiding of hair and putting on of gold, jewelry, or clothes. And the emphasis is not on what you're wearing per se. It's not your focus. It is the idea. It's not about the external. It's about what's inside. It's about your heart. It's about your heart before God. But let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart, with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. Which in God's sight is very precious. That is the worthy woman. And young men, if you find this woman, again, you have a treasure beyond that is worth more than anything that you can find in this life. Because this woman will help you get to heaven. This man will help you get to heaven, and that's the idea of all of this. Consider, think, young people, think hard, think deeply about the decisions you're making now, especially when it comes to whom you're planning on marrying, because it's going to have a significant influence over your children and you, but mainly your children.
these souls that you are responsible for. Selecting a job is another area where we make sensual decisions. A physical decision. Well, I've got this job offer. It's a good income, benefits, health insurance. It's in a place, you know, it's near the ocean. It's in the mountains. It's beautiful there. No state taxes. And there's nothing wrong with those things. But we make our decision based solely on that. And we move there and we're like, okay, now I've got my family here. We've bought a house. I'm planted here. I'm going to be here for some time. Now, where's the church? And a lot of people make decisions like that. And those are decisions that are based from a physical, sensual perspective. The spiritual way is, first of all, it's in this locality, this job with this great money. Man, and there's nothing wrong with money. Good money, it'll help the family out, man. We can have this. It'll be so helpful. Wait a minute. Where's the nearest church? And not just a church, right? You can't just show up in a town, Church of Christ, roll right on in there and everything's good. Because it says Church of Christ above the door doesn't make it so. We've been studying about that in the book of Revelations, right? There are five of those churches that had some serious problems that needed rectifying and needed rectifying right now. Or the Lord's coming to remove that candlestick. He's going to break fellowship with this church. You don't want to be a part of that church. Is it faithful? Is the church faithful? If you can't answer those questions, run. Don't move there. It's been said, well, just go there and start a church. You're going to drag your family there and move there, and you're going to start, as you're establishing your life in this town, you're going to, on every second you got spare time, you're going to start a church. I don't think so. It don't work like that. It doesn't work like that. If you're supported and you go into a place to try to get a church started, that's one thing. But if you're moving your family there, you've got a full-time job, and you're trying to start a church on your spare time, that is a mountain to climb. I'm not saying it can't be done, but that's not how we should be making our decisions for our family. I don't believe. If you disagree with me, that's okay, and we can talk about it afterwards. But don't move your family into a place that doesn't have a church. If you're a full-time evangelist and you're being supported in that area, that's one thing to do that, and that's an important work to do. But just, hey, man, I got this great job. We'll go to this place and we'll establish a church. It doesn't work like that, because there's some places where the door's not open, yes? And here you are with your family, and there's no brethren there to help support that. Because this is a support for one another. Trust in the Lord. Seek His kingdom first, and He'll take care of you. It's not about the money. It's not about the status in our job. It's not about the house we live in. It's about, are we setting our minds on the Spirit? And selecting friends is another area where we can make sensual and physical decisions. It's not just for the young. Apart from your family, who do you spend your time with? Are your friends spiritually minded? Are they interested in the things of God? Do they honor the Lord Jesus in their lives? Or is He just one of those famous people that people talk about every now and again? He's one among many. Will they tell you the truth when you're going down the wrong road? Will they rebuke you if it's needed? Faithful are the wounds of a friend. Profuse are the kisses of an enemy, the proverb writer said. Spiritually weak people do not have spiritually strong friends. And if we're running with spiritually weak people, we are spiritually weak people. If we're not, we're soon going to be. Because that's the way that rolls. Young people like to think, well, I'll influence them. It's not the way it usually goes. I'm talking about friends, people we spend a lot of our time with. We need to ask ourselves, why is this person my friend? Why am I running with this dude? Why am I running with this girl? Friendships impact our life. In 1 Corinthians 15, verse 33, do not be deceived. Evil companions corrupt good morals. We use that all the time with our kids. These worldly friends. And that's true. It has an application there. Worldly friends will influence us. But this is in the context of brethren. Right? People are teaching error. That's what this is about. You're running with evil people. Paul is calling, the Holy Spirit is calling people evil who are denying the resurrection. That's what this chapter is about. These evil companions are corrupting good morals is because they're influencing people through their false doctrine. So it has an application in the church as well. Again, we're talking about, are we running with spiritually minded people? Or are we running with those who are bent on life on this earth? If we are, then we're among them. With hard work and perseverance, you may accomplish great things in life, but on the judgment day, they're going to be absolutely meaningless. Meaningless. I understand God wants us to have a job. I understand that college is a part of that. I get all of that, and I'm not knocking that. Again, we're talking about what's driving the train. What is our focus in life? Is our focus on God and His things, or is our focus on our job? Or are these other physical things? The only way to eternal blessings is the way of Enoch, is walking with God. And we understand what walking of God with God is. It's doing what God says. And the question for each of us this morning is, are you walking by faith? Are you walking by sight? Decisions made based on our senses, based on our wants, our desires, always come at the expense of the things of God, of things spiritual. So we ask the question, what is your perspective? What is mine? Do I have the perspective of Cain? Or do I have the perspective of God and realize my mortality, my frailty, my need for God? Therefore, I will walk with Him. And each of us need to make that decision this morning. Each of us are making that decision this morning. If you're not walking with God, you need to start that today. And if you've never walked with Him, you start that by obeying His word, by believing that Christ is His Son, confessing Him before men, repenting of your sins, and being buried with Him in baptism. And as we talked about in class this morning, God raises us from the dead in that moment to walk in newness of life. And what a glorious thing that is. Am I right? It is. And once we are in that fellowship and relationship with Him, there's nothing that can compare with that. If you're here and an erring child, come now as we stand and sing together.